Nerd Appropriate presents exclusive coverage of the BioWare base, recorded live at PAX Prime 2013.
All right, welcome to the Rated NA podcast for the website nerdappropriate.com. As you'll notice, this is not a numbered podcast. We're doing a whole special series for you.
Yeah, we're going to be bringing you a total of 12 different podcasts recorded live at the BioWare base this year's PAX Prime. So make sure to click subscribe and enjoy.
Thank you for coming and joining us for the BioWare base panels for this afternoon. How many of you saw the Dragon Age panel? I thought so. We will talk later about what your most exciting thing was. But right now, we are talking about tactical combat. And obviously, that is not something that I am doing right now. So I am going to let the panelists introduce themselves, and I think that they've got some exciting things that they want to talk about, so I'm just going to sit here and relax unless they look at me and want me to ask them things. So let's let them talk.
Hi, guys. I'm Mike Laidlaw, the creative director for DA. Take it.
I'm Sebastian Hanlon. I'm the lead combat designer for Dragon Age Inquisition.
Cameron Lee, producer for Dragon Age Inquisition.
My name is Josh Stixma. I'm a combat designer on Dragon Age.
The man that made dragons.
My name is Matt Berner. I'm a combat and gameplay designer.
I'm Jacques Lebrun, technical director for Dragon Age.
Michael Liel, I'm a gameplay designer on Dragon Age.
Graham Scott, I'm a level designer. I've been working quite closely with the combat team for the last few months.
Yeah, anything goes wrong here today, our combat team is in trouble.
Yeah. Yes. Work is ground to a halt. So one thing, I if you don't mind, Jess. Oh, okay. I guess you really don't mind.
No, I don't mind. I was silencing my phone.
One thing before we get started, one thing I want to make clear, because not everybody made it to the DA panel today, is one of the big reveals there. And I know you're in a media blackout when you're in this space. It's like, internet? Yeah. It's like living in 89. The thing is that we have announced the return of our tactical camera, right? So, yeah. And everybody on this row, self-excluded, put a ton of work into this thing and making it come back. And the most important thing is, you know, it was originally a PC-only feature in Origins, didn't make it over to the consoles. It's universal. So no matter what platform you play it on, we got 5 supported, you will be able to use a tactical view, take a top-down view, pause the game, issue orders, and watch it all play out in real time. So, if your questions are about that, or if you're wondering why people are asking about that, that's why. They saw it in action today. I think Jess is hoop skirting, so I'll ask a few questions.
I thought you guys had questions prepared. Wait, no, I want to ask questions.
I'm all good, Jess. We're just fine. You just sit back. So, a few things I'd like to know, because I'm kind of unclear on how this works. I'm wondering if maybe Josh could walk us through kind of our general philosophy for the way the creatures behave, the way they interact, and, of course, how that applies to tactics and tactical thinking.
Sure. So what we really wanted to do from the get-go was start looking at these encounters that you're going to be facing in the world and start looking at the creatures as sort of tactical pieces, almost like you're playing sort of a chess game. And what we really wanted to drive down into is what is their role and what are they going to be fulfilling when you're entering combat? Because you sort of want to know prior to starting that combat, what equipment should I be using? What abilities should I be prepared with? So we sort of started on that approach, and that's sort of how we started formulating our creatures, using that as sort of the base of the actual creature. And then, you know, you build up, and he's got a shield, and he has this, and sort of leveraging all of those things. And by focusing on the individual pieces and then looking at it later in terms of, okay, now they're all together, what now do I have to learn when? I'm fighting this guy with a shield, and then an archer, and then this. It really starts looping in things together, and then from there, we start amping up difficulty and doing some other things, and Sort of wandering off a little bit there, but I like to talk.
That's all good. Matt, could you walk us through sort of the player side of things? Because Matt develops a lot of the player abilities. If you saw today, that awesome kind of hook shot to pull guys in and stuff, that's all coming from him. Matt, how do the player abilities interact with the creatures, and you know, how does that affect the tactical play?
I think it all starts with what's basically the combat loop. So if you think about it as like a, you've got a bunch of different states. You can freeze a guy. Well, once a guy's frozen, what can you do to kind of compound that? If you freeze a guy and you hit him with a big hit, you might expect him to shatter or something along those lines. If you went to and watched the demo earlier, you probably saw that in action. And then there's other abilities like the hookshot ability and stuff like that. We're able to kind of manage the field, control positioning, make sure that try to pull an archer who's retreating back to you so that your swordsman has an advantage in that scenario.
Cool. And then I think, you know, other big stuff is Graham. Graham, you are down there. Okay, good. Yep. Thought I heard you talk. And Sebastian, I've been doing a lot of work with the AI, right? The behavioral controls, both for the party and how they interact with the enemies. Guys, can you walk us through the kind of things you've been angling towards, what your aims are with those? Either of you can jump in and go to town.
Assemble, I'll let you start.
Okay. So, I mean, on the creature AI, we've had to rebuild the system from the ground up as we move to Frostbite, and really, again, trying to develop a creature AI that supports the kind of roles that Josh is talking about, where creatures can have a different movement style, a different way of positioning. They're going to try to take advantage of the way that you've laid your party out, the way that they pick their targets, the way that they interact with each other, and that's sort of the foundation of the creature AI. At the same time, while they're doing all these interesting things, and you can sort of learn, okay, this guy behaves like this. This guy is going to try to flank me and get around. This guy is going to try to target a specific party member. We want to make sure that the player is always able to learn and predict and figure out sort of, okay, if I know how this guy is going to work. And then, as Josh was saying again on the creature side, if I put these two guys together, it's a more interesting fight. If I've got this guy who's out in front sort of taking all my attention, and then that guy's going to try to sneak around and flank me. And then, of course, on the party side, we want to make sure that in addition to being able to go into tactical play and, you know, pull your camera up, move around, inspect the battlefield, give orders to your party members and control them directly, or by, you know, by giving orders and watching the fight play out, we also want to make sure that the party is able to support you even when you're playing hands-on, or if you want to be able to pause, give somebody an order and say, okay, go over there, and you want to be able to have a little bit of confidence that while they're over there, they're going to be doing what they need to do to support you using the appropriate abilities and such. So our focus for the party AI has been largely around making sure that they can support you as the Inquisitor, as the party leader, or whichever character that you're controlling. The party AI will you know, basically in its default state will support your activity as the player character. So if you're playing a mage, we want, you know, your melee characters to get out and intercept enemies that are going to come and try to take you down. If you're playing a warrior, we want to make sure that your rogue is going to be backstabbing guys around you, or, you know, basically supporting that character. Your ranged characters will stay behind the protective front line that you've tried to set up.
I think Sebastian covered it pretty well, but the idea, like, I'll just kind of add on to the party members. The idea is that, like, you are the Inquisitor, but depending on which followers you bring with you, you basically have a group of people that all have varying different abilities depending on how you actually level up your party and whatnot. And the idea is that that group as a whole is constantly working together. The AI is smart enough to be able to know that in this particular situation, these two characters can play off of each other in a certain way, and allow for opportunities to be taken advantage of. And I'll kind of tie that into, like, level design is another way that we can kind of provide opportunities for tactical combat to occur. So one of the comments that we often heard from Dragon Age 2 was the, how do they call it, the ninja spawning reinforcements from the rooftops. That obviously, that's not the most ideal way.
Wait, what? I thought everyone loved that.
Well, it's prime tactical opportunity, prime right?
Yeah, no.
But yeah, we heard in that. The end, that's what we're trying to provide the player with is tactical opportunities for them to make tactical decisions and be awesome.
Yeah, being able to again understand the environment that you're playing in, be able to predict. Okay, those guys are going to come through here, so that's where I want to set up my barricade. I'm going to throw down an ice wall there. Or I'm going to lay down a trap that's going to intercept those guys, and then I'm going to move my forces over here so that they have a flanking angle on them.
The overall presentation of TACAM, I think, kind of is reminiscent of almost a board game. And as I recall, Jacques J-Dog LeBron, that is not something naturally supported or natively supported by our engine. Could you talk about the difficulties in getting all of the RPG into Frostbite?
Yeah, where to start? So this is basically what we've been busy with for the last 2 years. Obviously, Frostbite natively supports a shooter, doesn't support an RPG that well. Fortunately, we know those systems very well, and that's what we've been working on for the last 2 years. We're using only the coreest of the systems that Frostbite provides, the animation systems, the rendering systems, but all the systems for running our AI, for controlling how the abilities play out and tie into the animation systems, those are all things that we've built from the ground up that these guys are just starting to just, take advantage of.
Perfect. And my final question of the salvo. Mr. Cameron Lee, in thanks for booking me into this panel 1 hour after and not giving me time to have lunch, what is fun?
Fun is whatever you want it to be.
Oh, good one. Yeah. No, so Cam's a producer. He obviously has a big focus on gameplay. So actually, the real question, sorry, was how do we tie this together as a group? Like, how does levels meet AI, meet new programming, and so on? You have a really good holistic view of the game. Walk us through that.
Yeah. So, well, I'm going to answer that with a couple other questions about other people, but
perfect.
I think it's about a vision of providing battlefield control. It's optional battlefield control as well. So, Mike talked a little bit about, I think, some other interviews, but about wanting to have an experience where the player feels like they can control the battlefield. And that battlefield includes things like some destructible objects. It's got the enemy AI. It's got the player's abilities. It's got the tac cam or the action cam, whatever you want to do. So it's your game, and you guys get to play it how you want to play it. So maybe if Mike or someone else can talk about battlefield control and why the tactical view is helpful and good for being able to control the battlefield.
I can.
There you go.
So a couple of things that are major change in Inquisition for combat, and part of the reason why tactical is such a major thrust, and again, this is news from the panel, so again, not all of you have heard it, is that you won't be healing instantly between combats anymore. You won't have, that kind of automatic recovery that we had in Origins and DA2. On top of that, kind of a compound item is that the amount of potions you have, there will be a limit. Now, the limit is flexible. It can change. If you have really skilled alchemists, if you collect some really rare herbs and so on, you can increase your healing potions. You can carry more of them. They're kind of a party-wide resource. So they're not. You're not going to be like, oh, I have one. It's more to put a more realistic limit and give you a chance to grow and have growth. This, though, really changes in our minds the combat dynamic, and it's something that goes hand-in-hand with the focus we have on exploration. So Inquisition has a huge focus on there is a big story, absolutely. But exploration is in a lot of ways how you progress with the story. It's not like, oh, good, you finished story part A, enjoy story part B. Instead, we want you to have that nice flow of like, I'm going out in the world, I uncover ancient mysteries. Oh, wow, I found a cache of weapons for my men, and now my men are strong enough to lay siege to this castle. That's the kind of cool flow that we think lets you honestly tell your own story and develop your own journey. But as we started to explore in that direction and building these big spaces that are you know, you take a mid-sized one, you can thunk the entirety of DA2 into it. What we realized is that, you know, we wanted to give players tools in their toolbox, and obviously avoidance is a tool. You can go around a group of enemies and so on because the spaces are very big and open. But of course, you know, why would you do that? I mean, shouldn't we just go get the XP? Well, again, having a consequence to every battle, you know, and if you play it sloppy and if you don't control the battlefield, aha, I've come full circle.
Yep.
You end it was coming. Then what happens is you end up injured, right? And suddenly this injury has a long-term effect. You know, if you are, you know, sloppily running through a dungeon and a trap goes off and scythes through, you know, Varric, well, now he's injured. And that means that you're going to have to either, you know, balance between using up resources to heal him or, you know, potentially using one of your big powerful spells or so on and so on. And those things all create, I think, a tension when you play. And as you have that tension, you then start to approach every fight as an opportunity but also as a risk, right? And it's up to you to balance that risk and that reward. And so as we started to come into that space where we were like, wow, we can honestly make even like three bandits on a road kind of consequential. I mean, they're not going to rock your socks, but still, they matter. And by doing that, we said, well, let's make sure that we're giving you the tools necessary to say, no, I actually could take those guys down without suffering any casualties. And if you can do that, and you can do that using maybe it's tactics, maybe it's just you've got a really good AI, maybe you've leveled up beyond this zone so you're tougher than the guys, all those things are going to kind of reduce the risk of that encounter, meaning making you more willing to tackle it. Because, again, they're full of XP.
So how's the tactical mode in Inquisition going to be better than Origins? I feel like so I've just done a whole bunch of press interviews, and I feel like I'm getting it back now.
Revenge.
Yeah. Although you have to do the same. So.
Yeah. Are you asking me? Or I think Seb should answer this one. Sebastian, okay. Do it up.
So why is it better than it was in Origins? There's a couple things. One is that we are able to bring it to all of our players. Across platforms, whether you're playing on Xbox or PlayStation or PC, we're going to be providing the flexibility to pause and position your camera, give orders, move around, inspect the world. And that's, yeah, like I say, we wanted to make sure that when we brought a feature back that's this important in order to be able to balance our combat around, in order to be able to use it as a what we call a first-class feature, that it would be available to everyone.
You can also spin around raindrops,
yeah,
which is really cool. It's like a Matrix cam. You just pull it up and you, like, spin around these raindrops. It's pretty wicked. So that's why it's better.
So the other thing, I mean, as we were developing this, we had to make a camera that would work with our interior spaces, that would work with the really detailed levels that we have now. So rather than being sort of a fixed perspective, you can pull the camera up, you can push the camera down, you can position it much more flexibly than you could in Origins. And then from any perspective, you can pause and play. And let the AI execute your orders, let your party execute their orders, and see how the battle turns out. On the console by pulling a trigger. On PC, this is very familiar. I can see the PC people in it's going, yeah, that's exactly what we had. Can't we just have it back? That's really been our model. Is how do we bring that experience of spacebar, issue, spacebar, stop, okay. New orders, stop, okay, and bringing that kind of pause and play experience to Dragon Age for everyone, and across the board in Inquisition. Let's see, we're also putting a lot more focus on being able to get information about the environment, and about your enemies. We call it the inspector. I think you saw a little bit of if you saw in the demo on the console, we have a little cursor that you can drive around, and that's where you place your orders, and that's where you tell people to go, and how to target things, and when you mouse over or when you drive your reticle over another character or an object in the scene, you can learn things about the environment. So that bridge that we blew up in the big presentation there. You know, if you're going in and scouting that area ahead of time, you can, you know, drive over and oh destructible. Oh, I wonder what that does then. Oh, and you can see those guys up there. And again, you can get stats and information on all of those characters. So that's again, it gives you more information and more time to look at the battlefield and plan out your strategy.
So, Graham, you work with both the combat team and the level design team. So, in a lot of ways, he's helping design encounters from both sides. Could you, and I think Josh, of course, working with creatures so heavily, could you guys talk about, you know, since we have these new destructible items in combat, you can try to change the terrain, you can throw up an ice wall and block stuff off. What effect does that have on the way you design the levels and the way the creatures have to be aware of them to interact?
I guess the simplest way I can put it is, as I said before, it's opportunities. As level designers, we're not just creating spaces that are either beautiful or that just exist because, like, here's a chapel because it's a chapel. We're actually creating spaces that are, it might be a chapel, but we're actually looking at the objects that should be in a chapel and trying to figure out ways that we can place enemy encounters that provide opportunities either for the enemy or for the player. We're not always going to be creating situations where the player automatically has the upper hand and they can instantly slaughter the enemy. There might be cases, for example, where the encounter is, it might be a trap and there might be a couple of three bandits that are there and their specific purpose is to lure the party into that space. And then once that happens, all of a sudden a destructible wall smashes open and the reinforcements come in or whatever the case may be, like with the behemoth there. In the demo, if you saw it, there was an initial foot soldiers that you were fighting, and then all of a sudden, boom, 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 out comes this big, bad behemoth.
That the destructible world really gives us sort of an alternate in to creating more gameplay, because we do have that the creature, the behemoth. He is actually able to destroy things in the environment, things that you may have been banking on. Like, okay, there's some cover I can hide behind here. The archers won't be able to hit you. Comes close enough, just smashes it. So those are the sorts of things that, once again, like going into prior to it, you're like, well, it does look a little rickety. Like, I might blow it up. So things like that the behemoth can do, we're sort of trying to get that into some of our other creatures. And that plays in design. Okay, you have archers. They can leap over this if they want to use it as a shortcut. We also have guys that will use it for escaping, and once again, guys that will blow a few things up in the environment. So it really creates lots of fun gameplay toys.
Yeah, there's also cases like with the party where archers, for example, can use certain objects as cover. And if you have a party full of warriors, you don't want to have your archers kind of pinning you down with arrow fire. But as warriors, you can basically run up to those objects, destroy them, and then all of a sudden you've got archers that are completely helpless because they have nothing to hide behind. So again, opportunities and finding ways to look at the environment, look at the creatures that you're actually fighting in any encounter, and seizing the opportunities.
One thing I'd like to make clear, and actually maybe you guys can jump in and talk about some of the changes. So again, a lot of you saw the presentation today. You heard Mark and I mention demo magic. So the encounters we had in the demo were changed from what they would be in Final Balance and stuff. And actually, maybe then we can anyone who wants to jump on it, can we talk a little bit more about Final Balance? Because obviously the demo looked relatively easy. Blair had also played it like 87 times, so that certainly lends a bit of credence to it. But can you guys talk about the overall approach and philosophy in terms of like how many enemies, or how tough are they, what kind of a challenge should I be expecting?
So the question was balance.
Yes.
Balance. So we approach on a couple fronts. We've got both a pause and play, and you've got like the party, what party members you're bringing into the battle. So if you bring in like a collection of warrior and mage and archer, and you kind of cover all your facets, you might be able to, well, deal with appropriate scenarios like thrown out earlier where there's like a wall you want to break down. Well, if you have a bunch of archers, you're not necessarily going to be able to break down a wall that you would have if you'd had a warrior. So there's some kind of like inherent balance based upon like the party you pick and the characters you choose, the abilities that you invest in and unlock. And then there's an additional balance that goes into, tuning the encounters based upon like enemy types. So for example, you might recognize like three swordsmen is a standard difficulty. You throw in a guardsman, all of a sudden it's like twice as hard. Or you throw in a mage who's going to complement their gameplay, and you've tuned the encounter differently. So that's one way we're trying to like play with balance, is just like different combinations of enemies, being able to be counterpicked with certain character plays.
Yeah, we saw that in the demo, actually. Mike mentioned that when the single guardsman was encountered, you could see how much more difficult it was. Like all four of the characters were actually just steamrolling that enemy, but it still actually took quite a while because his shield was just deflecting all of the projectiles and everything. You'd be amazed at just how much more difficult that one creature becomes when you throw in a couple of archers that can all of a sudden flank and provide cover fire for him. So.
Yeah, I would say that in general our philosophy for Inquisition is focusing on being able to have more challenging combats with smaller numbers of creatures, where each if you're foot soldiers and you have your archers, but as we start introducing more complicated and more challenging creature behaviors, like the guardsmen and the enchanter that we saw right at the end of the demo, or the behemoth that we saw in the caves, those in the final game, we'll want to make sure that those characters are able to hold their own, and that we want the fights to last long enough that you really do have time to experiment and to put your strategies into place as you go through those fights. A little more challenging both in the individual creatures and how they're able to counter your player strategies, and then also as Josh and Graham said, the combinations of characters who work well together, providing an additional level of challenge.
There's also a lot more optional fights that we're throwing into the game now. Those Omega weapon style encounters. Mm-hmm. Or first time you meet that dragon, he's going to own you. You're going to have to put a pin on it and level up a little bit more before you take him on.
That is a very good point. We've talked a little bit about non-scaling creatures. So as you're exploring the world, you'll come across areas where the creatures are under your level, especially if you've been there before, and those fights are correspondingly easier. But also very challenging areas that we want to make sure that you can recognize that they're an extra level of challenge, and that you should either come back later, or that you if you want to take it on, that you need to bring your A game. You need to really plan ahead and make sure that your whole party is working together.
Yeah, possibly even crafting the dragon, killing swords, and so on.
That's
true.
Can we fight a Nug? Can we kill a Nug?
If you're mean.
Oh, man.
Why would you?
Don't hurt it.
Mean like Cam.
Just, take it down and make it, sleep.
Okay. All right. We made it so cute.
Do we want to do some...
I want to do one more question on our end. So what we're going to do in the next little bit, because we're coming up on about half hour left, is I'm going to have, I think Hillary's around, and she's going to... David's going to do it. Okay, so David will do it, but don't mob him just yet. He's going to come around, he'll take your questions and so on. However, when you start your question, I'd like to know one ability or spell that you'd really like to see come back. Okay, no promises, but if you've got a favorite, walking bomb, then feel free to shout it out, walking bomb, and then walking bomb. So before we do that and talk about walking bomb, one very important question, because I just realized I went down the list and totally missed Mike Liaw, who is not uncommon because we have virtually the same name. Who knows whose email you're getting? But Mike comes from both a QA and a design background. He worked in as combat QA on DA2. He's worked with the team a long time. He's now a full-blown combat designer, and works with literally everything. So Mike, I know this isn't really your thing anymore, but could you help us understand the complexities of QAing something where the player could be bringing all mages, all warriors, that kind of stuff? How do you approach that kind of freedom that we're giving to players? And how do we try to keep some degree of balance on that front?
I think it's pretty interesting, actually. It's a unique challenge that QA has to solve for. And it's great because BioWare allows the players to have so much freedom in their approaches. So there's basically just a lot of just testing out, well, what kind of crazy things can we do? You know, what if we don't go with what the standard thing is that the designer is thinking of? Like, you know, I'm just going to be that warrior who happens to wield elemental weapons and brings capes to the fight, but, you know, I'm still going to rock it, and I'm going to do all that elemental damage. And, you know, it's great because we have so many fans who were able to discover that and find out that that was actually viable and one of the better strategies in DA2. And we just kind of test out with every single combination we can and try to just think creatively about how we're going to approach our combat situations.
How hard does the game get if you try to play through the game without any clothes?
Yeah. The ever popular naked crazy man.
Yeah. Naked crazy.
I'm going alone and unarmed.
The weapons.
Let's see what happens.
I meant like if I play through without any clothes.
Wow, Matt. Well, that was so much
that's difficult in a whole
much information. Then you have to moisturize. And on that ultra classy note. Let's go to Joaquin. Your questions, I mean. David is going to make his way around. If you have money, I hear he comes to your seat faster. No.
I had a question. If, say, like, your party member got knocked unconscious and the fight's over, would they instantly get back up, or would you have to, like, use a spell or a potion? Because in Dragon Age 2 and in the Origins, they immediately got back up, but right. They were injured.
So that's a good question. Again, tying back into what we were saying about non-regenerating health, they will get up at the end of the fight after the swords have stopped swinging. But obviously, they're going to be in a very bad position. They're going to be low on health. And so you need to be able to deal with that. Am I going to have them limp along into the next fight? Maybe it's not going to be so bad. Maybe I can, maybe I can fight with a party member tied behind my back. Or am I going to use a potion or use a spell that I can use then to get them back into fighting shape? Or if things are going too badly, do I want to go back to my base and get everyone back into shape?
So that when they recover, they'll recover to a certain threshold, but it won't be particularly generous. So they will have – I don't want to do the one hit point thing because that makes every fight be – they'll be exceedingly weak. So it'll be up to you how you handle it from there. Cool. Another one. You didn't say your ability though. Let's go.
You don't have to.
Yeah. Let's go with Resurrect.
Just say Walking Bomb.
Walking Bomb.
Say Walking Bomb. It's fine.
Okay, so let's assume that apart from just getting the equip and buffs from your magics, etc., you want to go a bit else and take your rogues and using your out-of-combat stealth, move to an advantageous position. But now you have your party split. Do we get back the out-of-combat use of skills to better prepare? And second, would we get some kind of minimap to help us at a glance get a better location of everyone? Because as marvelous as the new camera is, we still can't just see anything if there's to spread apart.
Yeah, the splitting the party always poses a huge problem for us. It has gameplay issues, right? I ran across 7 kilometers of an area and whoops. It also has huge technical limitations. That's it. So right now things are a little bit in flux in terms of how far we can stretch it. But you will be able to stealth. You will be able to separate the party to some degree. But I don't expect you'll be able to move the party to the other end of the map. It's just technically not going to be possible. In terms of your the idea of a mini-map, area map is absolutely in. Right now we're running with a compass. Mini-map, we're still exploring kind of the feasibility of it and whether or not it works with the terrain. That's, we've moved a lot away from, like, this is a flat dungeon, and now it's a lot more undulation, a lot more verticality, and that's kind of the only reason we haven't, leapt on it. But we're looking at it right now. Whether or not it definitely gets in, I wouldn't promise yet, but the joy of a year out means that we'll keep pushing at it.
There's definitely a lot of tech we're looking at to make sure the visualization of your enemies is really apparent. So we've got outlines that will show up through geometry that occludes your enemies. We've got, you know, the groundlings, so hopefully, I mean, it should make it a lot easier to spot your hostiles.
Hi, what thought was put into balancing people who are heavily using the tactical versus people who avoid it? As far as encounters, because obviously somebody who's heavily using the tactical can be very precise with their party control versus somebody who avoids it completely is going to have a little bit of a disadvantage as far as fine-grained control.
I can jump on that one.
You want to talk intensity?
Do it.
So we're actually kind of approaching it from both aspects of design. Like, yes, there will be players who want to play through fully tactically and are via that mode, and they want to just engage, like use the engage function and kind of like watch the people execute the commands they're doing. And there will be people who want to play in the moment and control kind of third person style. Knowing that, our abilities are designed with that in mind. We have things like modals that you turn on and kind of equating to like holding down a button, that type of stuff.
The other thing, Mike has used the phrase an intensity modifier, which is how one way we look at the tactical view and the pause and play gameplay style in general. So, if you run across a harder encounter, it's a higher intensity. If you turn up the difficulty, it's a higher intensity. And by using pause and play, you can bring the intensity down to whatever level you feel comfortable playing at. So. For an easier fight, or if you're playing on an easier difficulty level, it may be more comfortable just playing in the moment. Or if you're if you're at a higher skill level, if you're more comfortable playing hand to hand. And at the same time, if you're playing on a harder difficulty level, or if you're facing down a really challenging encounter, then you always have that option to pause and consider and get a little more time and a finer control over your party and exactly what they're doing and where they're going.
Player.
The enemy AI? No, the enemy AI is consistent. Yeah. And then the party AI, of course, is responsive to your commands.
And I think this is probably something that just goes to the core philosophy, is that, you know, we've been through a lot of discussions because, you know, you have to acknowledge there's some people, they see tactical cam and go, turn-based, or some, they have a weird reaction. other people have an equally weird reaction to, oh, God, it looks like an action game. Right, like that's part and parcel of it, and the simple truth is, like, you know, you cannot please everyone. So our goal, rather than trying to be like, oh, we'll make it so you never really have to use TACAM, which would be too easy if you did, and oh no, I don't know, you always have to use TACAM, which is too hard if you don't, is to say our expectation is that you guys will use TACAM when you feel you need to, and that's really why intensity is a better thing to talk about than difficulty, right? Because difficulty is a player controllable slider, but I don't want someone to set the game, you know, to nightmare and, you know, to have experienced it. It's their third run through. They've equipped their guys to the nines. They've got amazing tactics, but they still feel like they have to use pause and play. The AI has to be smart enough. Your capabilities have to be high enough that is a functional way to play. But there, even then, when, Lord, you know, Miss High Dragon shows up, you're probably still going to be tempted to use pause and play, and will probably do so. And to me, I look at pause and play as, you know, a first-class action, a core user interface, and it's that. It doesn't change the balance. It doesn't. Nothing hits harder. Nothing hits lighter. And, you know, your party is equally effective, but it's an interface and a tool at your disposal. And my thought is that as you start to gain mastery on the game, as you start to play on the higher difficulties or tackle the harder challenges, right? Like, oh, I'm going dragon hunting. That tool should be something that becomes increasingly part of your repertoire. And with that in mind, then our design has been. To try and make it as easy and as seamless for you to use as possible, which is why if you look at the way the console version of it plays, the controls are virtually identical. The same button to throw a fireball throws a fireball. It doesn't suddenly pop up a bunch of radials and menus and drop-downs and stuff. It's designed to feel like almost the same experience from a different point of view. And the better we can get that and the more seamless we can get that, which is a constant thrust for us, then the smoother it becomes. Not a, are you going to play tactically? Are you not going to play? It's more just, are you going to play? And how you play is up to you.
Hi. So my favorite ability is definitely heal. Nothing more tactically advantageous than that. My question, one of my favorite things about Dragon Age is the ability to customize your party's AI. I want to know what are you keeping from earlier versions of Dragon Age, and what are you changing about that?
I can feel that. So as I mentioned earlier, we've had to rebuild our AI systems from the ground up in Inquisition. But obviously, we recognize that player tactics, customizable party tactics, was a very popular feature. Being able to say, "Okay, I want you to use this ability. I want you to stay close to me. I want you to being able to set up your AI, and then again, be able to pull the trigger and watch your tactics play out, and have your party really support you in the way that you want to play." We're still in development on exactly what that's going to look like, but I can tell you that definitely we're going to have a way of customizing your party's AI behavior, and again with some of the changes that we've made to the way that the AI fundamentally works, being able to have a lot more control over where your party's positioned relative to each other, being able to really make sure that you can control which abilities they use when, how they spend their resources. That's definitely the kind of things that we want to make sure you keep control over in that screen.
Yeah, I think we can expect a few changes to it, because one of the things we kept running into, there were kind of a twofold problem that we ran into with the current tactics. It was kind of tennis, you know. When you first try to play tennis, you go poof, and the ball goes sailing, and then you have to run and get it. It's not very fun for a very long time. My wife plays tennis, hence the metaphor. It was a pretty fragile system in that, like, you know, if you put things in the wrong order, it could break very easily. So our goal, I think, if anything, is to make it a little more robust, so that if I say, well, I want to drink healing potions when I'm at half health or something like that, that isn't somehow negating everything else you're doing because you put it in the wrong order. So we're kind of exploring how we can make it a more holistic system in the way it feeds into the AI, so that the long-term goal is that the party should be predictable and competent, I think, are really the two watchwords, right? So when I enter battle, my archer is going to move to something that is close to cover and will, you know, likely take up station there and tend to use his or her best abilities, right? Cool. That's a predictable action, and something that as a player you should be able to tweak until you're like, cool, that's exactly what I want them to do. And of course, competent, meaning that they dish out the pain when needed. So there you go. That's kind of our long-term goals. We'll do some deep dives next year in terms of, like, okay, so here's where tactics has landed and so on. Cool.
Staying on the topic of that sort of thing, I wanted to know if there's going to be, or if you've considered, like, is there going to be a limit to the amount of AI slots you have as far as different abilities, or will that be taken away, or will it be a greater number and not just like four? Or?
Still in discussion. The question of whether or not we actually even have slots in the same way is something I think we need to lock down first, because there may be, again, like I said, the ordering of that could cause problems. So we'll keep iterating on that and stuff. I know DA2 to DAO, you basically were like, here you go, I have 20, and away you went, as opposed to having to spend skill points to get it up. You can argue both sides of whether that's a good choice, but regardless, I intend to give you a fair amount of control, and I think that's where the team's been pushing, and the AI is certainly designed to let you do that.
Okay, I have questions. Wait, I have to do this.
Is it a list?
Yeah. She's got a little. Just a little. Got a book. I've already asked one of them.
Yeah, we should probably, because we have so many people,
yeah,
we
no,
should
I'm,
probably
I'm just...
just
looking for the one that I had.
Okay, just okay. One question.
The destructible on the destructible environment, is the entire environment destructible, or are you focusing on destructible pieces that exist placed around the battlefield you have to be aware of and use these?
Mike?
Mike?
Mike makes things break, you see. Excellent. He's XQA, so we let him stick with what he knows.
Pretty good at breaking things.
Breaking.
So what we're looking at right now is specific pieces in the environment to kind of modify combat. So we want to actually make you look at the environments that you're coming into for the combat encounter and really think about what should I interact with? And so it's not the entire environment, but it is specific pieces to it. So that bridge or things of that nature. A bit of both, actually.
So they're not. We didn't go with the fully physics-based destruction because we didn't want you walking around destroying the world of Thetis. So they're
nothing but a pool of lava left by the time you're done. Take that, Darkspawn.
Yeah, there are definitely very targeted, specific things that there is a reason to destroy them.
Handpicked objects.
I think there's like some pottery that has some incidental destruction.
And, well, most of them will break, and like there's stuff that you can like kick around and stuff, but they are mostly state-based.
I do have one really good piece of news. So thus far, I'm looking at everybody significantly. Thus far, we have avoided the red barrel with a fire painted on the side.
Yeah. I'll bring it in.
But we did break crates. We already broke crates. Our time to crate was -1 year, so there you go.
Despite having to rebuild the entire game from ground up, what has been the most challenging aspect of making Dragon Age Inquisition?
The entire move to Frostbite has definitely been a huge challenge for the team. Everybody's got to learn new tools. All the programmers need to learn completely new systems. It's an insane effort for a team to move from one technology to another. I'm a little biased, but I would say that's definitely been the biggest challenge for us is moving to a new technology. Certainly, there's a lot of design complexities in terms of more open environments. Mike can maybe you can talk a little bit more about that, Graham.
Sure.
I think the philosophy behind the way that we're building the world has definitely changed. I would actually probably agree with you that the tech is probably the biggest single thing. Everything else is it's any game that you work on, you're kind of evolving things and like you have a game plan, and I think we kind of took the feedback from previous games, and like it was kind of a given that we were going to be providing bigger areas, I would agree definitely.
There's one meta challenge you wouldn't expect necessarily, but for DA2, for Awakenings, for Mass 2, for Mass 3, all of those were on kind of platforms we knew. They were on technologies we'd known and started to master over time. And it's kind of funny watching the team psychologically be frustrated because...
That is funny, Mike.
It's hilarious. No. It's because you wouldn't expect it, right? Because, you've got pro game developers and so on. But the thing is that these are teams that are used to being fairly high functioning, right? DA2 came together very quickly, and there was a heck of a lot of effort put in, but we knew the system so well that we could do that. Mass 3 was something where at that point we'd worked with Unreal for so long, it was so well, and so there's been this this difficult transition in understanding that it's like uphill on sand and loose gravel the entire way to a team that's used to being like, let's get in there. And that's there's been times where I think it's been hard, right? It's been particularly hard because you're used to being able to make this thing sing and dance, and all the tricks and how to optimize memory and make it so it's going to sing. And so there's this kind of psychological weight when you have a team that's used to performing at a very high level and very rapidly and like, cool, let's do some quick prototyping, to the point where I remember myself one day saying to Mike Liao, Mike, could we have put a stun after you hit him? And Mike went, yeah. And I went, really? Holy shit, that works? Awesome. And it's, we kind of went through a period there, especially that first year where it was just incredibly hard to even do anything. I'd like that guy to walk. Ooh, jeez.
Yeah. 3 weeks of programming incoming. Yeah.
Does he have to turn left?
What do you mean by walk?
Yeah, I mean, certainly after we get out over the hump of Sucktown, moving to a new engine, seeing all the potential and all the new things you can do that we couldn't do on our old engine, you guys haven't seen that Dragon in action, but when you do, it's going to be amazing. And yeah, that's certainly not something that was possible on our previous technology.
Okay, so we're getting to the end here, so we'll do two more questions, okay?
Hello. First of all, I would love to bring back the virulent walking bomb, please.
That's my boy.
Not just exploding corpses, but corpses that make other corpses explode.
He's got a beard. That's his, he's got the taste.
So I've been playing computer RPGs for decades, and one of the things that sort of disappeared towards in two at least, I think so, was the queuing of actions. Mm. When you're talking about bringing back the tactical view and telling your people to go here and do this thing, go here and do that thing, a lot of what Neverwinter Nights originally did really well, and other games have done really well, is the ability to edit your queue of actions based on what the enemies are doing in response to what you're doing, instead of having to reset everything every time. And I'd like to know what's happening to that.
Well, our current approach is identical to what we have in Origins, right? So we have the queue of one, and then, of course, you the thing that we have, again, you couldn't ever do on console and could kind of do on PC, is the ability to issue orders on the fly as you go and as you adjust. Thus far, that's kind of been our target, to make sure that we can recreate the Origins experience, and that in and of itself has been pretty challenging. Queues have pluses and negatives, right? And we have explored them, and we will continue to do so. So I can't really confirm whether or not it'll happen. The pros to queues, of course, is that you get to feel like smarty pants, where, you know, cool, I'm going to do these three things, and I'll kind of watch this little symphony of death play out. The downside is that queues tend to work better in sort of a turn-based kind of sequence where thinking more of the Final Fantasies or the Grandia, in fact, has a queuing system. Matt and I geeked out over Zigrandias in times, where the enemies kind of move and they, choreograph and then break apart, right? And you have that kind of thing. The combat in Inquisition has pushes. It has, like, a crit hit that causes the guy to stagger back further and so on. So there's more chaos in terms of the way that they can play out. So there's a danger there of a queue becoming this unpredictable thing where it's like, oh, that suddenly became an invalid state and the queue just explodes, which you can handle. But after a while, like, if that becomes too common, the queue itself becomes kind of this vestigial, not very useful thing. So we have to be very careful in terms of balancing putting it in and making it absolutely work if we're going to do it. Queue of one, we can because it's within a very tight time frame, we can do it. And in many ways, we're also kind of a queue of 1.5. If you say, I want to hit that guy with a whirlwind, then your character will move and execute, right? And they won't just, I'm a whirlwind right here, that we leave that to Minsk, right? On one of his bad days. So we certainly 1.5 for sure. In terms of deeper queuing, it's something we've started to look at and to see, but we kind of wanted to get over kind of that first milestone beforehand. So, it has appeal. It also has downfalls, and Mike would tell you it's a bugger to QA. So, but we'll see. One more.
Tempest.
There you go.
Tempest. And Chain Lightning. Okay.
Nice.
I feel like you should stand up because you're obviously Plymouth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I can stand up. It's hard to stand
awesome.
Up.
Awesome.
There we go. So this has been nagging me for a really long time. It's a potions question.
Sure.
So in Dragon Age 2, I believe, it seems as if I bought up all the potions. I couldn't buy anymore or whatever. I'm not sure if that's right or whatever. Couldn't buy anymore. I would have to, like, make them or something. Can I just continue to buy them in Inquisition, or do I have to, like, craft them or something? Me too lazy.
I think that speaks to what Mark was talking about before. Like, we want people to focus on the entire journey and the entire experience of running through. You leave your outpost and you go and you do some stuff. if we just let you have tons and tons and tons of potions, then it kind of trivializes all the fights. So every fight should matter. So in terms of potions, I'm sure people will be selling potions in the world somewhere, but you can craft as many as you want, and you know, there'd be increasing strengths as well to look at. So there'd be a variety of ways to do it.
Yeah, our goal with potions is that rather than having to purchase them, the nice thing, one of the neat things about exploring the space of you being inquisitor, right, a leader, is fundamentally you have people for that, right? You're the talent.
Bring me potions.
Yeah, and so our goal with potions is at a base level they are incredibly easy to work with and to restock, right? Like, cool, I'm going to bring some healing and some protective, and so on. But then there's that there should be, ideally, the allure of these cool, powerful potions that I can start working towards and almost researching in a way by engaging with the crafting system. And to keep it relatively clean and easy to understand, but not, again, keeping it very easy to keep yourself stocked. But if you want to participate in improving and going that extra mile, that's where you start getting into a little more mastery and you start thinking, ooh, I need more deep mushrooms. I guess I'm going underground, right? And that that'll if anything, what I'd love to see out of potions is more so than I'm going to go to the shop, is you almost as a player should be giving yourself quests based on, like, I really want better potions, and it's pretty easy to restock them once I get them upgraded, so I'm going to go hunting these specific things in order to get that effect. And then I don't have to worry about store capacity, I just have to worry about being able to track those down. Cool, and I think that is all we have time for today.
Do you guys have any last thoughts before we let these guys on their merry way?
Cheer if you like ground rings.
Ground rings.
Ground rings?
Yeah.
Wow.
Nope. Yeah. Cool.
One person likes ground rings.
Okay. Wow.
Okay. Ground rings are tight.
Yeah. So easy. So easy.
Wow.
I have one final thought, and again, because I'm just coming off the big panel, I know a fair number of you. If those of you who came, you were there at the panel, some of you, I hope. Yeah. Good. Oh. Cool. It was great for me. It's really the first time we'd shown the game on a big scale anywhere outside of, BioWare, really. A couple of EA execs came, but they still had to come to our house. And I know for these guys, I went out and grabbed a quick drink afterwards, and everybody just had that kind of giddy thing. So my big thing is to thank you all for coming, for cheering, for enjoying it, and for, your enthusiasm for Dragon Age. So I really appreciate that.
Oh God, I didn't realize that there were things like hidden in the skirt. So that's tactical combat. Sorry, I need sugar. Go.
One last thing. One last tiny reveal. Bowstrings are here. Bowstrings are here
bowstrings!
In Inquisition. Five people love bowstrings. So
no, you heard it here first.
Animated bows.
Yeah. I got it asked a lot at Gamescom. I was like, I don't know, guys.
Yep, they're in.
Someone go tell the BSN. They'll be
BSN. Please. They'll be so happy.
You're posting right now? Okay,
please,
good.
Please do.
And that brings us to the end of this episode's BioWare-based panel coverage. We hope you enjoyed listening.
Thank you so much. You can find us on Twitter @NerdAppropriate or Facebook/NerdAppropriate. Email us directly. That is Matt, Hillary with one L, Scott, or Ash @NerdAppropriate.com. And we have over 100 episodes to check out. So definitely subscribe and let us know what you think. Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone.